Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Welcome to this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, the chairman of the Humanities Forum, which organized today's event. We also welcome our listening audience, both on the radio and online, and we invite everyone to visit us at www.commonwealthclub.org. It's my pleasure today to introduce Professor Fleming from Stanford, the author. Santa Clara University, who wrote the book, The Taste for Civilization, and she has a very interesting thesis about why we've lost civility in our conversations on TV, our political discourse, in society altogether. And she doesn't blame it only on the baby boomers. So, thank you.
Okay. Well, I am delighted to be here this evening to talk about a topic that dovetails nicely both with the central purposes of this organization, promotion of a common good through consideration of public affairs, and with the theme of this lecture series, the ascent of women. At first glance, it's not obvious how my topic, The Taste for Civilization, Dinner Table Democratization, has anything to do with either public affairs or the ascent of women. After all, isn't the dinner table private, not public? And isn't progress for women measured by less time in the kitchen and more time in the worlds of education and employment? Let's begin by thinking about a common good. This feels like a deep breathing exercise. We are so accustomed to thinking about politics in terms of partisan strife, heated arguments, and gridlock that to focus on a common good is like inhaling mountain air. It is invigorating, opening our minds and our imaginations. It has become quite fashionable to maintain that Americans have reached a point where we cannot agree on a common good. I disagree, and I suspect you do as well, or you wouldn't be interested in a Commonwealth Club talk. To my way of thinking, to despair on a common good is to misread U.S. history and to suffer from a serious case of poverty of imagination. At least since the ancient Greeks, politics has been about imagining a common good, the ends of politics, and deciding who should have voice and power in its creation, the means of politics. In the United States, we have seen seismic shifts in accepted wisdom about the common good, voice and power. Notable examples are the abolition of slavery, the enfranchisement of women, the extension of civil rights, and improved working conditions. I call your attention to these examples as a reminder that seemingly intractable political differences can, over time, become settled. So when we think about today's seemingly intractable issues, it is important to remember that conflict is inevitable in politics, and in the past it has taken civil wars, civil disobedience, and strikes to remedy these conflicts. There never was a golden age of perfect harmony, nonviolence, and civility in U.S. politics. However, just as conflict has been universal, so too, I would argue, have been the beliefs that there are more or less civil ways of resolving conflict, that it is better when arguments produce light rather than heat, that diplomacy is highly valued, and that people like to think of themselves as virtuous and civilized. I know that use of the term civilization is controversial, both because of its use by Western imperial powers to distinguish themselves from so-called savages, and because the current depictions of a purported clash of civilizations between Muslim and non-Muslim worldviews. I would like us to expand our ideas about civilization beyond these formulations. In contemporary politics, the word civil has three meanings: the status of citizens, civil society, and the manners of the civilized. You are quite familiar with citizenship and its relationship to the common good, as reflected in discussions about birthright citizenship, pledges of allegiance, loyalty oaths, and the civic education for our youth. Civil society is probably a less familiar concept. It entered Western political thought in the Renaissance and remains a hotly contested topic that has been dubbed the big idea of the 21st century. It figures prominently in the politics and concerns of disparate groups. Around the world, civil society has been a rallying call for pro-democracy advocates in former Soviet republics and in Latin America. In the United States, civil society is important for libertarians who want to reduce the scale of federal government, for communitarians who want stronger family, neighborhood, and religious associations, and for civic-minded pundits and scholars troubled by a disengaged citizenry. These disparate groups share a common assumption that civil society is a realm of human association separate from the nation, state, and from the economic market. Contemporary interest in civil society is in part a corrective to an exaggerated emphasis on the state and the market as optimal forms of human association. Across the globe, the state-based model loomed large between the end of World War II and the mid-70s, with intense focus on capitalist welfare states and socialist central planning. Then, from the mid-70s until the early 90s, the market was ascendant with Reaganomics and Thatcherism, codified in Margaret Thatcher's famous dicta, quote, "There is no alternative to the market," and, quote, "There is no such thing as society." The 1990s saw renewed interest in the relationship between the state, the economy, and civil society. Civil society is a complex puzzle, and it has three essential components: associational life, the good society, and the public sphere. Writers differ in their respective weights they give to these three elements, but a common thread is the notion of civility. Civil society is not just society, it is civil. Political writers have danced around the concept of civility rather than embrace it. This is in part because they've been focusing on the state and the economy, and in part because of the historical baggage of civility as quaint, old-fashioned, and stifling. This brings us to the third meaning of civil, the manners of the civilized. Michael Walzer observes that political theorists have been focused on the state and the economy, and they've neglected the networks through which civility is produced and reproduced. He correctly points out that most men and women have been trapped in one or another subordinate relationship where the civility they learned was deferential rather than independent and active. So it is important to reconstruct the dense associational life of civil society and its attendant norms of civility under new conditions of freedom and equality. Civility in a democracy is not the superficial glossing over of differences. Indeed, it is a virtue that is called into play precisely when there are differences, especially among strangers. In Stephen Carter's view, civility is a virtue that equips us for everyday life with strangers, our daily democratic train ride with people we do not like or do not even know. It entails a generosity that assumes the best, not the worst, of the stranger. Civility requires generosity even when it is costly, and trust even when there is risk. The adjectives civil and civilizing are frequently used to describe activities at the table. Taking turns talking, listening attentively, learning from different age groups, eating no more than one's fair share, meeting the needs of the group, showing respect for different tastes, breaking bread with companions, celebrating birthdays and anniversaries, honoring religious and ethnic traditions, meeting for coffee or tea, entertaining friends at dinner, sharing weekly meals with an extended family, experimenting with unfamiliar cuisines, and addressing differences with diplomacy. In spite of these daily experiences with the civil and civilizing, table activities are usually invisible in discussions of civil society. Table activities should receive more attention insofar as they provide opportunities to practice the art of conversation and the virtues of thoughtfulness and generosity. If everyday table activities are so important for civil society and democracy, why have we not taken them seriously? In my view, it is because they have been seen as private and feminine. Since Aristotle, Western thinkers have defined politics as occurring outside of the household. For thousands of years, Western thought was predicated on the idea that the common good entailed separate spheres, public man and private woman. Public man would go out into the hurly-burly world of commerce and politics. Private women would maintain the household. In the 19th century in America, these spheres were given a moral gloss. The public sphere was amoral or immoral, and private virtue was maintained by women in the home. According to the cult of domesticity and republican motherhood, the home was a refuge of moral virtue, in contrast to the cutthroat world of industrialization. Moral private women had to civilize immoral public man. In their 70-year struggle for the right to vote, most 19th century women, with a few notable exceptions, adhered to the view that politics could use a dose of women's virtue. Some reformers argued that corrupt machine politics should be swept away with a broom. The battle by women in the temperance movement against demon rum was a moral crusade, but we often forget its economic side. Married women were civilly dead in the eyes of the law, and husbands could spend the family's wages on drink with impunity, making it impossible to feed the family. And drinking fueled domestic violence. Second wave feminists in the 1960s challenged the separate spheres worldview, maintaining that women's place was not just in the home, but also in colleges, the workplace, and electoral politics. Their vision of the common good was twofold: opportunities for women outside the home, and men's participation in household tasks, especially food preparation and childcare. They also challenged conventional thinking about the common good with the slogan, "The personal is political." Everyday life was political. Questions of power, justice, and equality emerged in daily conversations about the sexual double standard, the division of household labor, domestic violence, sexist jokes, media portrayals of women as sex objects, and assumptions about women's mathematical and scientific abilities. Since the 1960s, there has been unprecedented progress in women's employment and educational opportunities and achievements. Even though we still have a wage gap, a glass ceiling, too few women in elected office, the feminization of poverty, and violence against women, there has been a sea change in consciousness and politics related to women's entering previously male worlds. But little has changed on the stalled part of the feminist agenda, convincing men to share household child care and food work. Today's working women confront a double day or second shift of a day at work and evenings and weekends of unshared household tasks. Many women are exhausted and resentful. We now have a leisure gap as well as a pay gap, and discussions of virtue politics have fallen by the wayside. Given the historical durability of the separate spheres worldview, feminists have been ambivalent about the value of domesticity. Denied access to the male world of achievement, many influential writers saw the household as confining, and they placed little value on food preparation in the home. In The Feminine Mystique, Betty Friedan described the home of suburban American housewives as a comfortable concentration camp, where trapped women were dependent and gave up their adult frame of reference to live at a lower level of food and things, performing tasks that were endless, monotonous, and unrewarding. In The Second Sex, Simone de Beauvoir's view of food preparation was marginally more positive. Household work consisted of uncreative and repetitious duties rather than the preferred transcendence of the male world of self-expression in meaningful projects. At least with food work, women could get out of the house, go to the market, feel part of a group, and be creative as a cook, even if, as she said, the validity of the cook's work is found only in the other's mouths. But of course, the devaluation of domesticity and of food work accepts the conventional view that what happens outside the household is more important than what transpires within it. The economic ideas and technological practices of the dominant culture have seeped into the household and civil society. Eat as fast as you can, fuel up, so you have more time for what is really important, work. Answer emails at midnight so your boss knows you're a serious worker. Take cell phone calls during dinner. Surf the internet for the latest bits of information rather than engage in extended conversation over meals. Watch TV during dinner. While many feminists saw no problem with beating a quick retreat from the kitchen, others questioned the entire premise of devaluing women's everyday lives. Given the complex history of women's relationship to food and domesticity, the task, as I see it, is to extricate the civilizing functions of food work and recast them in a way that benefits women, society, and the polity. American women have historically been responsible for the civilizing functions of food: meal planning, table courtesy, the art of conversation, family and group rituals, and in this capacity, modeling the virtues of thoughtfulness and generosity. The rise of fast food and the decline of leisurely meals mean fewer opportunities for everyday civility in speech and practice. Civil society and democracy would benefit from a social change where food work, conversation, and food rituals were seen as everyone's responsibility, and an economic change of a shorter workday to allow time for meals with their civilizing functions. My definition of feminism is taking women's experiences seriously, and my book project began as a response to women being ground down by the demands of the double day and their gnawing feeling that something important was being lost as common meals gave way to the time demands of work, school, extracurricular activities, and the screen culture of television and computers. Numerous studies have found that frequent family meals are good for us in many ways. They reduce the likelihood of at-risk behavior of adolescents, such as drug and alcohol abuse. They promote healthy eating, and they promote language development. Between 2/3 and 3/4 of Americans tell pollsters that they regularly have family dinners. Scholars are skeptical of these polls, since many studies where participants keep time logs indicate that only about 1/3 to 1/2 of families with children sit down to dinner each night. However, the polls are clear that most Americans place great symbolic importance on family meals, that they go to great lengths to make them happen, and that dinner is the one time of the day when family members can listen to each other. Americans report that they spend most of the mealtime engaged in conversation, and studies consistently show that it is women who promote the art of conversation at the table. Conversation requires courtesy, a respect and willingness to consider things from the conversant's position. Table manners are one form of courtesy. They are the conventions that make conversation possible. Courtesy predates liberal democracy's emphasis on freedom and equality. Courtesy, like persuasive speech, involves some holding back of what one really wants to do and say for a larger common purpose, an enjoyable meal or a good law. Being less than forthcoming is justified for a larger purpose. Thinking of a circumspect, if not entirely candid, answer to a host's question about the quality of a dish served at a dinner party is the same skill as crafting a respectful, if opposing, response to a legislative colleague. In both cases, reason is not relied on in place of or in opposition to strong feelings or self-interest. Rather, reason is used to deliberate about alternative courses of actions in settings with emotional import, hosts wanting to please guests, and strongly held views, political arguments, political opponents having major differences of opinion. Civil relations create reservoirs of goodwill that can help people get through rough patches. Democratic human associations cannot last for long without such reservoirs, given the inevitability of conflict, cruelty, and cycles of hard times. I'm sure you've heard a lot about the depletion of the reservoir of goodwill in Congress. The Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania has been monitoring civility in the House of Representatives since 1985, and it has sponsored bipartisan retreats for members and their families. According to Representative Ray LaHood, Republican of Illinois, these retreats lead to friendships that help Congress members solve problems and pass legislation. In 2006, members of Congress formed a bipartisan House Civility Task Force. Congress members attribute the decline in civility to several factors, such as year-round money-raising, the 24-hour news cycle, and hostilities on talk shows and the blogosphere. Many bemoan a decline in socializing across party lines. When the Republicans gained control of Congress in 1994, House Speaker Newt Gingrich urged his colleagues to leave their families at home in their home districts and return to these districts every weekend, so they wouldn't socialize with members of Congress. Recently, Senator Max Baucus, Democrat of Montana, said that Senate divisions were epitomized by the empty tables in the senator's private dining room. a place where members of both parties used to break bread. Nobody goes there anymore, he observed. When I was here 10, 15, 30 years ago, that was the place you could just go and talk to senators, let your hair down, just kind of compare notes. No spouses allowed, no staff, nobody. Now it is empty. Informal conversations create reservoirs of goodwill and allow people to see each other as human beings, not just abstract position holders or partisan opponents. A recent poll found that Americans are fed up with incivility in politics. They overwhelmingly think that civility is important in a democracy and that it is possible to achieve even when people disagree. A majority, including nearly 6 in 10 women, said that they were turned off when politics became rude and nasty. Only 20% said it prompted them to become more active in politics. Most Americans want compromise, which is hard to achieve when our elected officials have a hard time talking informally with each other. Political arguments are certainly a mainstay of democratic politics. But as linguist Deborah Tannen has noted, an argument culture can create an adversarial stance where winning becomes more important than understanding or conflict resolution. Indeed, the very ability to formulate and engage in rational argument may depend on a social connectedness that stems from conversation and intimate talk. In order for democracy and civility to thrive, people need frequent, everyday occasions to share pleasures, fears, and opinions with others. The household table provides just such a place. Children can learn about thoughtfulness and generosity, hear life stories from generations other than their peers, and see how conflict can be managed without coming to blows. At the table, they can learn about their identity and what is expected of informed citizens. By becoming participants in meal preparation, they can learn that people have a responsibility to take the needs of others into account without becoming martyrs to the needs of others. By pitching in to feed others, they can learn the importance of daily doses of gratitude for healthy social relations, and they can play an active role in creating a greater good. The table activities that have been at the center of women's lives in the historical division of labor should now be at the center of all of our lives in order to promote civility and democracy. In a time of widespread alienation from politics, Americans have to look carefully for those places where we routinely come together for something important and pleasurable, where we put aside certain differences in order to share something common with others, and where we afford each other the courtesy of a conversation. In short, where we practice being civil to each other. There is a connection between being cut off from food, meals, and conversation and the table, and being politically alienated, voiceless, and uncivil. Sharing a meal at a table is a temporary yet frequent locus of civilizing and democratic practice. People of various backgrounds and opinions agree to speak civilly to each other in order to enjoy the food. Heated argument can wait, since the attack mode causes indigestion. People take turns, listen, and respond politely. The pleasures of the table include convivial talk about subjects worth talking about. The time has come to take a hard look at the social and political costs of America's fast-paced convenience culture. It is important to encourage face-to-face conversation at the table, to understand why meal providers feel so pressed for time, and to examine realistic alternatives, especially in households with single parents or two breadwinners. In everyday life, conversations do run the risk of leaving less verbally skilled conversants stranded. However, true conversations are democratic insofar as conversants are tuned into differences in extroversion, sophistication of vocabularies, self-confidence, and the like, and they make adjustments accordingly. And where better to take such differences into account than at the temporary democracy of the table, where people have the motivation and the time to hone these skills and develop this art. I would like to conclude with a story about the concept of temporary democracy. I recently received an email from a woman in Washington State who thanked me for coining the term temporary democracy. She runs an after-school cooking class for fifth graders, where she says, students exercise skills necessary for an effective democracy while in the kitchen. During their meals, when children notice that they take too much food, they sheepishly put some back into the serving dish and pass it on. They respond graciously as they learn the give and take of living from a common meal. They appreciate the food because they're well aware of the effort it takes to get it to the table. Each day, children are invited to participate in soapbox sharing, where they stand on large fruit crates and share what they learned about cooking, healthy eating, or anything else they are proud of. Let's value the time it takes to position food, meals, conversation, and civility in their rightful place in our understanding of politics. Let's appreciate the virtues of thoughtfulness and generosity, of listening and sharing ideas in the pleasurable context of delicious food and food rituals. And let's expand our imaginations about what constitutes a common good and how we might achieve it. When I conceptualize the temporary democracy of the table, never in my wildest imagination did I think to associate it with fifth graders standing on soapboxes, but that's democracy. Thank you for your attention, and I look forward to your questions.
Thanks, Professor, for that great talk. Now there's questions from the audience. I'll get this started. I have a question for you. Mm-hmm. You talk about the long history of the lack of civility. I mean, it goes back forever. One of the ideas that we discussed at Monday Night Philosophy is that all ideas in civilization are the same. There's always the same ideas, but they have different market shares at different times. In other words, the idea has a bigger popularity at a certain time, and then it goes downhill and it goes back uphill again. So how would you compare the current civility? I mean, do you think that civility is losing market share still, or is it starting to come back, or when did it lose market share? Why is it declining?
Well, it's interesting you'd cast it in terms of market share, because the whole point is thinking about civility as something that's not market.
Good.
And it's precisely not market, not the state. It's something else that happens that's about how humans relate to each other. And, of course, deep interpersonal relationships have been around for forever. But I think, as I said in my talk, that we have put so much attention to the marketplace and to the nation state that when we think about politics, you know, we don't think about it in terms of these kinds of associations that give people voice and power and happen every day. And I think it's not unrelated to the fact that it has been seen as that's what women naturally do. They naturally, obviously, civility is taught. It is not natural. So it takes a lot of work. And the assumption is, you know, that someone will be doing it. But I think the fact that women have done it and that it's supposedly natural, we haven't really examined it. So in terms of the history of Western thought, we've thought a lot about it in terms of nation states and things like that, but not in terms of the table and relating the table to this larger politics.
I give a lot of thought to all the comments that you made. Usually every day. The common denominator that I came up with is there's too much money in America. And that money allows for a lot of toys that are extraneous and take away from democracy. And I think the best thing that's happened to this country is this current recession. Because I think what it'll do, as the money disappears, people will begin to recognize that there's an old story, it's the root of all evil. Mm-hmm. I think money has separated the families. And the more money you have, the more playful you can be. And that takes away from the dinner table.
Okay. Well, I think that historically there's always been great wealth and great disparities of wealth, so maybe it's most useful to look at what's going on right now. There always will be people with wealth and people with less wealth. I think when most commentators look at wealth in our contemporary society, they not only look at disparities between the very wealthy and the very poor, but they also look at how most people look at their relationship to work and wealth and what's important. And generally, the 20th century and the 21st century have been described as mostly consumer cultures, that it's not only that there's disparities of wealth, but it's that in our everyday lives, most of us are taught that what's most important is consuming a large amount of things. That's the American dream. After 9/11, we were told to go out and buy things. So if we look more focused on what we're living right now, and what I see as eroding the kinds of things I'm talking about, is that we've all agreed to work long hours, much longer than in Europe. The studies show that in England they work 3 weeks less than we do, and in France and Germany they work 9 weeks less than we do. We have come to believe that we have to work not just 40 hours anymore. Janitors work 50 hours now. Everyone is working really long hours, 2 to 3 jobs, to maintain levels of consumption that we think we all need. So I think what's happening is what the recession has triggered is when people don't have that money to consume, they're making stews and soups and eating together at home. And light bulbs are going off. So I can't say I like the reason why it's happening, but it's definitely true. When you get off that rat race, you stop to think about what is really important. Now, I know lots of people have to work 2 or 3 jobs to feed their families. But for those people with jobs where that isn't true, I'm seeing signs of people saying, everyone go home at 5 o'clock. Have flexible work schedules. So something's got to give. I teach in Silicon Valley where the 24/7 ethic literally is 24/7. You literally have to answer emails at midnight or you're not a serious worker. So that's what's wrong with this picture right now, is that we have to question. In the 1930s, the Senate passed a bill mandating a 30-hour work week. There's nothing eternal about a 40-hour work week, for those of you lucky enough to have such a short work week. but this has crept up on us. The time, there's a whole time movement out there. How has time just sort of crept up and taken our lives? So there isn't time for this kind of balance that I'm talking about.
And there's an easy way to pretend that you're a serious worker, and that's to set your alarm for midnight, get up and answer the emails and go back to sleep. Which quite a few people.
I just sent your email for I'm out of town. I'll get back to you tomorrow. But this is almost, I start to think about it, be a quasi-anti-feminist sort of thing. But if you take the family meal as one cohesive set and expand to the next level, it becomes the neighborhood. And we have somebody here from co-housing. But in the old days, there would be, at least in the area where I raised my children, block parties and other things, and the non-working, and that was all a feminist movement as women got to know their neighbors over, the traditional in the 50s, 60s, just having a cup of coffee while discussing whatever the hell they discussed, which was, soap detergent or whatever, according to the commercials. But there was this cohesive thing within the neighborhood, mm-hmm. which I think has vanished, to where if you live in a lot of suburban places, Brentwood, it can be Mesa, Arizona, you may not even know your neighbor's names mm-hmm. anymore. And does that cause a breakdown in civility? And, is that just an interim level here? And I guess an unrelated question, is there any way we can quantify civility and relate it to such things as changes in income distribution, which we can readily quantify?
Well, to answer your second question first, yes, political scientists, I'm sure you're familiar with Robert Putnam's work on social capital. Political scientists have attempted to quantify this kind of social cohesion I'm talking about, they typically call it social capital, and they look at such things like membership in organizations and how much you trust your neighbors. And so, yes, there's a huge literature on quantifying social capital. Civility is a little harder to pin down, and especially, as I suggested, once you try to go inside a neighborhood or a household, then you're getting in the realm of non-politics for political scientists. So one of the things I'm really trying to do is saying this is political too, and let's look at what's going on in these areas, and let's look at people's ties or lack thereof. The neighborhood question is really interesting. Yes, it's true, as people, it's back to the time thing. As people are working longer hours and commuting longer distances, there's less time in the few hours there are, people want to spend maybe at home and not doing neighborhood things. And there's also been the assumption on the part of a lot of people in many neighborhoods that the neighborhood just isn't safe. And that's one of the chicken egg things, that therefore many parents are booking their kids round the clock because they so fear unsafe neighborhoods that they book them round the clock so there's no time for downtime for kids, which is bad for kids, they're overscheduled. But it's and therefore meals are lost in that equation too. So the perception of neighborhood is extremely important. One of the positive things, though, that I talk about in the book is how food is bringing neighborhoods back together with community gardens and farmers markets and shared plots, even in urban areas. I've had some people criticize my book as being so California, but even in parts of the country where you have good weather a lot of the year, you can have neighborhood gardens, and you can get to know your neighbors that way. So yes, neighborhood is also an important component.
There's a related question that I got. Could you say something about the relative value of nuclear family dinners versus extended family dinners, where the latter includes different generations and childless uncles and aunts, including gays and lesbians, mm-hmm. and the nuclear family tends to exclude them?
Very good question. In the book, I typically talk about households, because obviously households is a much more accurate descriptor of places where food happens, because nuclear families with one income earner and two children is a very small proportion of all households. So, yes, I think it's very important to think about the many kinds of households we have in the United States. And I personally think that the more varied the kinds of households and the kinds of meals that people experience, the better off people are in terms of civility and conflict resolution and seeing different people as human beings who eat and like food and are funny and tell jokes and tell stories. Stories are hugely important at the table. And all the studies show that what's really important are stories, not so much the grilling. What did you do today? And, kids get really turned off by that. But hearing stories, it humanizes. And, yeah, the larger, the more diverse the food setting, the better for democracy, definitely.
In fast food, you've seen some, steps in the right direction with reducing trans fat. So what can the fast food industry do to make more, bring more civility to dining?
Whoa, what can the fast food industry...
Sorry about that.
Well, I think that in many ways, the fast food industry, well, it's complex, but a lot of it represents the antithesis of everything I'm talking about, because, of course, the idea is to get in and out fast, and so the chairs are as uncomfortable as possible, so the kids go run and play in the climbing structures. So the idea of being comfortable and sitting and savoring and conversing, it goes against the whole definition of fast food is to get you in and out very fast. So now, it is also true that we are now much more a nation of takeout, and that takeout is a good option for a lot of really, really busy people that will have other people prepare their food. So the argument I make is that while for convenience, it's very understandable that we're doing what we're doing, but the cost of that is... for example, not including household members in food work. There's a cost to that. I mean, a lot of parents think, oh, my child who's just been through these, you know, school and all these activities exhausted, the last thing I'm going to have them do is help me do food. Ironically, children love to be included in food projects, as evidenced by these fifth graders. I mean, tonight is their graduation. I was emailed by this woman, and they're all making meals for their family and showing off and getting little certificates. Kids love doing this, and we're sort of protecting them from something that I think they want, especially when their parents come home really tired. They want to help mommy who looks like she's about to scream. You know, they really, all the studies of children and family or household units show that they want to be helpful, and they can tell when adults are stressed out, and if they can do something to help. And in many low-income households, the children make the meals. So I'm arguing that this is important to put food and that the time it takes to do food things, because it gives you a sense of, oh, I made my family happier tonight by pitching in and chopping the carrots, okay? So we ought to think about that, is, I guess, what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. And what you're also saying is that adding a McSalad to the menu doesn't really make it all better, right?
Kids like to make salads, creative salads.
No, I'm sorry. Adding the McSalad to the McDonald's menu doesn't make it all better.
Right, right.
You're reminding me of a family I knew, I don't know, maybe 20 years ago, who had decided that at the end of the day, everybody was frazzled, close to meltdown, kids, parents, everyone. And so they elected to have their main meal at breakfast.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And they spent an hour and a half or so every morning at breakfast, mm-hmm. when people were rested and the kids pitched in and, mm-hmm. you know, did all of the things that I think we would categorized as civilized, and mm-hmm. everyone got off to a very good start.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I'm just asking for your comments on that idea.
From the reading I've done, there are many households who do that, who figure that's realistically the only time of day they're going to see each other. And they will make that the common shared meal. And I think the important thing is, I don't think there's one cookie-cutter solution to this issue. I think households vary enormously of who's there and what time they're there. And, of course, the households change over time in terms of the aging of the children and coming and going and grandparents and uncles. And so there's not one solution, but I have to admire the creativity of households who are trying valiantly to maintain some time where the group can be together and have time to converse.
On the temporary democracy idea, I was wondering if you looked at any of the hostesses from the Washington 50s and 60s, and like Sally Quinn, for example, who would bring these disparate people together for dinner. And if that is continuing now, or if that's kind of died off.
I'm sorry, in Washington, D.C.?
Yes.
I can't say as I know. Again, there are sea changes in Congress members' behavior around socializing, but from all accounts I've been reading, I mean, they have to go to these structured retreats to get to know each other as human beings. That's pretty...
So maybe not.
Yeah, so maybe not. Is that a question?
I wonder if you could talk about connections between the movement that you've identified and the slow food movement, mm-hmm. which has been perceived in its start as a gourmet versus family kind of mm-hmm. gathering.
Right. Well, most of what I'm saying is perfectly consistent with the slow food movement. And I realize the slow food movement has had many aspects to it. It did start as a revolt against a McDonald's going into the Spanish Steps in Rome and Petrini getting out there with grandmothers and their pasta saying, eat this instead. So it has a populist part to it. It has been criticized for being elitist in some ways, that they want to preserve certain kinds of foods, and it's getting into class and race kinds of issues when other food is invading Italian food. So, you know, it's It's like every other movement. It has many parts to it. But I think the main argument about the importance to slow down and savor food and to say no to time demands and to carve out time for food and to preserve things that take a little bit of time to make are worthy goals.
I'd like to remind our radio and online audiences that you're listening to Professor Meng's talk at the Commonwealth Club of California. There's time for more questions.
How do you think taking Wall Street out of the equation would benefit your cause?
Well, we are a capitalist system, and I'm trying to find solutions within a capitalist system, which are pressuring the workplace to have expectations of fewer hours of work. And I think that's an achievable goal, even though it's hard, because the ideal worker in our current economy is someone who has all the household things taken care of by somebody and can work really long hours and move. Okay, so lots of reasons why the ideal worker conflicts with what I'm talking about. That's right. So it is related to the economy, but, you know, I have seen signs that this concern is resonating, particularly among people who have fond memories of what family meals meant in their own development and their ability to be taken seriously, to be asked, well, what's your opinion of this? Many households have these rituals, you know, tell me at least one thing about your day, the best thing, the worst thing. And so you get used to being a person who matters. And, you know, if you don't have that at a place where you matter because of who you are, not because of how well you do in school, not because of how much money you make, not because if you're the star soccer player, but just because you're you, you know, we pay a high price by not having those occasions. So it's more of a time critique than anything else. But that's huge, because time is huge. So. Mm-hmm, definitely.
I think that's what you're addressing.
Definitely.
Well, there's many of us here who might remember the prediction of the New York World's Fair in 1964 that by the year 2000, because of productivity, that we'd all only have to work 10 hours a week.
Mm-hmm.
one of the predictions, along with flying cars, that didn't happen.
Definitely.
You mentioned the robot. Another question. Something else, and I have a question from earlier on. You talked about that people found civility too deferential. That the habits of civility are too deferential, and that this may be part of the problem. And of course, one of the switches over the last couple of centuries is away from aristocratic monarchical societies to democratic ones. And a lot of people feel that in that switch, we've lost something beautiful. We've lost something. And I thought I'd propose an idea that would help us start to divide the two things, which is that voluntary cooperation is a virtue and obedience is a vice.
Well, you're definitely right about the class nature of courtesy. I mean, the notion of courtesy, of course, came from the court of Louis XIV, where none of us would want to go back to, except maybe to enjoy the food. yes, it's a medieval, it's a feudal notion, it's an aristocratic notion, and the people who've written about manners and civility have talked about its class nature, how the aristocrats came up with certain rules, and then the bourgeoisie, who were wannabe aristocrats, would adopt these rules of civility and courtesy. And even in this country, George Washington had rules of civility and conversation, which are a list of maxims that he copied from a Jesuit manual from the 1500s on how one ought to be civil in conversation. That was his education. So manners and civility were seen as appropriate subjects for our founders to think about and talk about. And of course, when I just reread them today, and many of them I quote in my book about show respect, do not turn your back in a conversation, do not lord over the conversation, are things that are that we are transmittable to today. And he also said, eat food only in season. So Alice Waters and George Washington, you know, agreed. But many of them we would see as not that important, and they did involve deferential. You know, when you're dealing with someone superior to you, act in a certain way. But what I'm arguing is that we should go back and draw out those things that are useful to us today and make them democratic, so that the reason we show respect to others in conversation is because they're equal moral agents, not because there are aristocratic superiors. So certain behaviors for different reasons. And we need rules. And so it's a question of who gets to make up these rules. And of course, there is more or less democracy at tables. I mean, some tables are horrible. You know, there are people who study households where literally the father comes in and there's a belt hanging behind him. And that's dinner conversation. Okay, so there's nothing magical about a table. It's just that it can be an occasion where there is a more participation on everyone's part and not one person lording over, which is the feudal model of one person lords over and the rest shut up and listen. I think most of us are more familiar with more democratic tables. And even ones that are conflictual, there's enormous cultural differences. Some people love to have raging arguments at the table. In some cultures, that's what you do. They think we are so boring here that we don't do that. And in some cultures, attentive listening is seen as culturally appropriate conversation. In Asian cultures, there is, you know, so we have to be careful of thinking, oh, there's only one way of having conversation. And that everyone has to talk all the time. That can be really hard on people who are shy. So I'm just saying, be sensitive to the notion of different kinds of conversations, but I honestly think when they're respectful and for the right reasons, they are democratic.
As an undergraduate, I took several courses that revolved around food and food rituals, and I remember taking one course specifically that was about food rituals as they are portrayed on film. What role do you think the popular media should or could play in relaying a positive image of food and dining rituals?
Well, that's a great question. There have been a few classic, you know, food meal movies. But I honestly think that there haven't been that many really good ones that set good examples. I mean, there's a few that show how meals were sort of essential in keeping the group together. Babette's Feast, of course, is probably the classic of transforming a whole community through a meal. So there are some good ones, but I think meals are pretty marginalized in film, on the whole, in most films most of the time.
My Dinner with Andre.
My Dinner with Andre, definitely a conversation, yeah.
I was just curious if you could tell us a bit about your upbringing and your family situation around the meals.
Great.
Some personal.
It's interesting you would ask that, because when I was last home talking to my mom, it turns out my father was very insistent that each of us talk at the table, and it turns out it was his idea, not my mom's. Usually it's the woman who does this socializing. But she said, it never dawned on me, but my father would insist that we each say something about our day and no phone calls during dinner. My brother tried that once and learned that it wouldn't happen again. So I just thought this was normal, that people got voice at a democratic table, and parents really took interest in, and we had only three children, so it was easy to get a word in edgewise. So I guess, I mean, part of my writing this book was I thought this was really important, and I'm struggling with, you know, is this worth keeping? And my dad came from a farm family of nine, and I only imagine it happened at that table too, with less time per person, that he must have learned it from his family.
One follow-up question. When your brother answered the phone, did the father take that belt down from behind the...
Ah, was not my family.
Oh, okay.
Other than a current notion put forth in the American Jewish community to turn off electronic devices on the Sabbath to spend more time with each other, are you aware of any other movements for people to interact more as a family on a particular day of the week or some such notion?
Oh, a particular day of the week.
Or, you know, any other movements for people to turn off distracting electronic
There's a
devices.
Whole literature of the time movement, take back your time movement. In fact, they all want us to realize that as of October 24th, people in France and Germany will have stopped working, and we're working those extra 9 weeks. But they have a whole movement website about people around the country who are taking back their time in many, many, many ways. And it's interesting because it's environmentalists and it's feminists and it's leftists and it's church people. Anyone who thinks there's something other than work that's important that we ought to be spending a little bit of time doing that involves face-to-face social interaction. And back to the earlier comment, it's not necessarily just a nuclear family. It's time for, you know, picnics have plummeted, the number of picnics that people have, you know, kinds of getting together, block parties, that kind of thing, around food. So I refer you to the time movement. They have more ideas than you'd ever want to know about how to take back your time.
Well, I'd like to refer you also to tasteforcivilization.com, right, where the book that she wrote is available. We were hoping to have a few copies here, but they did not arrive from the publisher, unfortunately. We found out a little while ago. In addition to that, I was thinking that in our consumer society, maybe we should resurrect the idea that time is the greatest luxury. Then people might think of it as something they can consume. Who would like to, we have time for one more question. Who would like to ask the last question?
In terms of civility being considered deferential, there's some cultures, I'm thinking Japanese, in some contexts, where it's actually a position of power to be civil and deferential and mm-hmm. listen, and that can be used in a way that puts you in a stronger position. So mm-hmm. you mentioned diplomacy as something that you learn at the table, and I was wondering if you could comment on civility being something that could actually be a very empowering thing and mm-hmm. not viewed in the other sense.
I'm glad we're ending on the notion of diplomacy, because that's the other puzzle that I had in writing this book. How is it that in every culture, diplomats are highly valued and it's just assumed that every culture can produce diplomats who are precisely people who are trained when crossing cultures, say U.S. and Japan, to know exactly what is insulting, what is, you know, empowering, what is seen as an insult, and they have to go through years and years and years of training of understanding this. And if you look at U.S. culture, where in our own culture we have, you know, so many different groups that to navigate our own cultures requires enormous diplomacy. And yet, where are we learning this? Okay. So I agree with you that civility and diplomacy are empowering, they're valued, and yet we just assume they're going to magically appear, and they don't. They take all this constant work, which is the whole reason I wrote this book. This takes a lot of work to learn the art of conversation, which, again, it's not natural. So I agree with you that if we take diplomacy as the standard, it's extremely empowering, because it means you're able to communicate with a very different other in a way that's respectful, that you can actually accomplish peace or something good like that. Nice way to end.
Yeah, one last comment about that, too, is that I think it's because we have an entertainment-based society, and a large part of the reality TV shows and the talk shows and even now the intellectual shows on Sunday mornings are fights rather than discussions, that this is a form of entertainment, and the form of entertainment is that you say, well, you know, my life might be screwed up, but look at how screwed up they are. And that's not empowering to see that these people, I mean, look what happened to Howard Dean when he kind of lost it. He lost his whole presidential race. And so I think it is empowering for somebody to stand up and calmly address the issues. It's just we don't see it so often, so they don't get into power very often. So,
right.
Thank you very much,
thank
Professor.
You.
And we also thank our audience here at the club, as well as those listening on the radio or online. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, held during its 107th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.